Okay, welcome everybody at U of T. This is going to be a very fun topic. We won't have time for everything, but I think we'll have enough time to really appreciate the depth and wisdom of Chazal, of the rabbis, and we're going to get into some crazy modern-day applications with it. We live in a world where you could sit in shorts and a t-shirt, and you could totally chill, and using the power of speech, you can accomplish many, many, many things. We know we have Google Home or Alexa or Google Echo. What are the options today? Siri, right? Siri's a more clear form. But all these things, and you could literally just sit there and say, Alexa, on Shabbat, right? Deliver me, order me books or pants or clothing or whatever you want. And it could show up even that day or the next day potentially. You could sit there and you could order, I don't know, Alexa, I want a fresh, clean coffee, and the coffee maker will go on. Or even more creatively, you can have raw chicken in the oven. You could say, turn to 350 degrees. Turn to 350 degrees. An hour later, you could have incredible hot chicken, which would be 2 hours later. That'd be delicious and wonderful. And the question is, can you do these things on Shabbat? So this comes down to how we analyze speech. What role does speech play? Is speech considered a creative act? Meaning, we know in Jewish law, we're not allowed to dig a hole. That is the prohibition of choresh, of plowing on Shabbat. Can't dig a hole. But what happens if I want to dig a hole, and I don't want the hole, but I want the
dirt?
That is called what? Malacha she'ina tzricha legufa. That's called doing an action, and you don't want the actual action. You want the byproduct of the action. You want the dirt, not the hole. That is a rabbinic prohibition. It's not biblical. It's not daraisa. It's under abundant. Why? Because it's malacha she'ina tzricha legufa. You're doing a creative act, but you don't want what the act generally produces, and that's a hole. You want the result, the byproduct, which is called dirt. So, okay, this is good, good, right? Okay? Talks with this, spends a lot of time in the Talmud about this topic. It's a very important principle. Because we know that in order to violate a biblical prohibition, a Doraisa on Shabbos, you have to do a creative act. One of the 39 biblical prohibitive acts, right? So, classic example, the difference between writing with a pen versus writing with
pencil.
Actually, no, that's a great guess. But actually, pencil is considered permanent, but great guess. You know,
writing
you go,
in the sand.
Writing in the sand would be a very good example. I go, and you write like that, right? Those things in would disappear. In Israel, many, many, many years ago, they had a pen that they would use in hospitals that the ink would only last less than 24 hours. So therefore, it's temporary. So they would write, and they'd have to copy the document, the nurses and doctors would hire people after Shabbat to copy the various notes. A lot of problems with that, just from a technical perspective, and now you don't need to anymore because now we basically say anything digital is rabbinic. Typing on a computer, using a cell phone, those are only rabbinic because it's electricity, not really. Okay, good. I was worried that my son called in the middle of this year. It'll disrupt the recording, but it didn't. Excellent. Okay, so that's the way it works. Okay, fine, wonderful. But how do we view speech? How do we view speech? Is speech considered my action? I'll give you an example. If I go to somebody and I say, drop dead, and they die, did I just commit murder?
No,
why not? Do I violate Lo Tirtzach? Well, don't murder?
Did your telling them drop dead directly lead to them dying? Did they die because you told them to drop dead, or they were going to drop dead anyways and you happened to just tell them? How do you know?
You didn't cause it.
You're like, what are you? Maybe I walked into the ICU unit and a person who's basically taking the last breath and I say, die, and they die. Right? Okay. But what about if I am a very Kabbalistic person and I understand the various, you know, Kabbalistic understanding of the universe? And I'm tapped into the spiritual realm, and I have this ability to do, you know, magical incantations. And I go over to somebody in the name of God, blah, 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 drop, and they die. Would you think I violated the Tirzah?
Not in halacha.
Not in halacha. I did not violate Jewish law, murder.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Okay. Rabbinic prohibition? Nothing.
No, like moral.
But meaning, right. Meaning, so could a court do anything to me? A Jewish court, could it do anything to me?
No.
Nothing. Okay, I didn't do anything. It's cool what I did. Pretty cool, right? Make some money off of it. I could make a lot of money off it, actually. I'd actually be pretty wealthy if I could do that, right? But I would not be able to be incarcerated, both probably from a secular perspective, I don't even think so, right? Halakhic perspective, you don't think so. Okay? Interesting. Okay. Do we know anybody who created something with speech? What's the first example of someone who created something with speech? When I mean the first person, I literally mean...
Let there be light.
Very good. God creates the world through speech. Vayomer, let God say, let there be, and there was. Let there be, what? God created... Basarama marani ra'olam. Mishnah Perek Yavos. God said there are 10 utterances of God created. God created the world through speech. So maybe I could conclude that I can create through speech. And therefore there's no difference between you die and... You don't like that analogy. Why don't I like that analogy? Why?
Because we're not God.
You can save time. How can you draw a parallel to what God does to what Greenberg does? Right? And Greenberg thinks he's God. We're in bigger problem.
But
Kurdi Batel Elohim. What? Kurdi Batel Elohim. Okay, we're saying Batel Elohim, but we're not Elohim. Right? Right? There's still a difference.
That was pretty weak.
Right? Why is that weak?
Well, no, it's a weak argument of me.
Oh, you. That's right. Okay, good. So, and take a look at source number one. Source number one says, it's a Gemara. Yodea haya betzalel lesaref otiyot shivu v'shon. Betzalel had this incredible wisdom, and he knew how to create. And what would he do with his words and letters? He knew how you're doing. He knew how to create things. That was an incredible... chair right there. Okay. Okay, so how do we know this? And he quotes a pasuk, "V'maleo so ruach Elokim b'chachma b'tfuna v'das." That's source number one. Rashi says the letters that were created, heaven and earth, are yedei tzerufan u'b'sefer yetzira. And Rashi says, "Betzalel, the person, the architect of the tabernacle of the Mishkan, he knew." When it says that he was an incredible artisan, it doesn't mean he knew how to bang, 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 that he took, you know, mechanical creating at U of T. But instead, he understood it was a spiritual type of creativity. What do we see from here? That Betzalel knew how to create things using the power of speech. Right? Now, and by the way, he built the Mishkan. Where's the source for what is prohibited on Shabbat to do? The building of the Mishkan. So maybe you could say, what? What are you talking about? I just said God created the world through speech. Betzalel, the chief artisan of Mishkan, created the speech. Maybe you'd say that creating through speech is creating. But there's a problem with that argument. And the problem is, intuitively, like, what are you talking about? The guy speaks and he creates. How could that even be? What would be even such a rationale behind such a thing? And we know that if you can dig a ditch, and you're digging a ditch and all you want is the dirt, that's rabbinic. How in the world are you going to tell me that speaking and creating something is biblical? It would be impossible to say that. Because you need what's called melechet machshevet ha-Torah. The Torah says, in order to do something prohibitive on Shabbat, you need to have intent, and it needs to be a creative act. Right? You have to do something. You need a maisa. You need an action. There's no action. Or is there an action? At least the first glance when it comes to speech. What do you need to do something? Right here, hard to imagine at this point in time. I'll give you another source number two. Should I do source number two? Okay, I'll do source number two. Source number two is the following. So I'm going to say this outside just to save a little time. Moshe Rabbeinu died. Moses died on Shabbat. At the end of davening, the end of prayer service at Mincha in the afternoon, we say a prayer called Tzidkar Chatzedek, which is the end of the afternoon service. And it talks about how God is righteous. Why? Because all the people who died, on over Shabbat, their souls are not tormented. Their souls are in a go to Gan Eden, they go to the Garden of Eden. And at the end of Shabbat, that status can change. And the Talmud says that Moses died on Shabbat at the end of Shabbat. And he died at the end of Shabbat, and because he died at the end of Shabbat, we do not learn serious Torah learning at the end of Shabbat because Moses died. And the concept, when a great righteous man dies, his study hall, Beit Midrasho Batel, the study hall is not used because the mourning of the loss of a person. And therefore, since we're all the students of Moses, that's why during Sudashi, the end of Shabbat, usually there's it's story time, there's shmuzes, there's not real heavy-duty Torah like we have here at U of T. Right? It's usually shmuzing time. Fine. But the Talmud asks a question. And says, not the Talmud, the rabbis ask a question. I understand. It also says somewhere else that the day that Moses died, he wrote 13 Sifrei Torah. He wrote 13 Torahs. He gave one Torah to every single tribe, and he kept one Torah as a copy. It's like the proof text copy. So, how can Moses write 13 Torahs the day he died? When did he die? On Shabbat. So if Moses dies on Shabbat, how can he write 13 Torahs? He can't write on Shabbat. Moses kept Shabbat. On this, he said, what are you talking about? Moses, you know how he wrote? Through his speech. He knew to use certain words, and that group wrote the 13 Torahs. Wow, that's pretty amazing. Okay, there's a lot to talk about this. The point is that we see that Moses... What do we see from here? That writing through speech isn't writing. Because if writing through speech is writing, how could Moses violate Shabbat? Okay. The next example is that let's say there's a scorpion and a snake. Not a dangerous one that's going to kill you, but an annoying one. And it's going to bother you. It'll bite you, but it's not poisonous. It's not. So the Talmud asks the question, are you allowed to do the following? Are you allowed to recite? Two issues of how can Moses write a Torah and speak. The Minchas Asher, the great rabbinic authority, in source number 9, says, what are you talking about? How in the world can you compare these miraculous situations of speech and extrapolate to the laws of Shabbat for human beings? People who know how to whisper incantations, Moses writing the Torah. And by the way, we also know a case that Moses, what did Moses do? Moses also killed somebody. Using speech, right? The rabbis say he killed the Jew as an Egyptian, he's beating up a Jew, and Moses killed him, and he killed him through speech, says the Talmud. And so he killed him through speech. How is Moses able to do all these things? The answer says the Minchas Asher in source number 9. What are you drawing conclusions about the laws of Shabbat from this spiritual, Kabbalistic way of doing it? You can't draw parallels to that. Those are unique situations, right? This is a segula. He says these are, you can't compare. God can choose that if I say sin, that person dies. That's not me killing them. That's God killing them. Don't, because I know how to recite some, that's not the person killing. That's God. You cannot draw conclusions or parallels. So in fact, we're back to square one. But is there a case that we see that speech can be creative? So here we go. Source number 10. There's a law in the Torah that if I am plowing with an animal and there's food, I'm not allowed to muzzle an animal. What's that called? Lo tachsom shor b'disho. You're not allowed to muzzle an ox while it's threshing because it wants to eat the food that it's threshing. And it's considered cruelty to animals to muzzle such a ox. Not allowed to do it. So the Talmud asks a great question. Let's say you don't muzzle an animal, but instead you scream at the animal, stop! And the animal gets startled, and instead of eating, it moves the head away because you scared it. Is that a violation of lo sachsom shor b'disho? Do you violate the biblical prohibition of don't muzzle an animal? Not if you put a physical muzzle, that of course, but what if you prevent it from eating? How do you prevent the animal from eating? I yell at it, stop! And prevents from eating. Is that considered a violation of lo tachsom shor b'disho? What a great question. Oh, here we see speech. Speech! I'm screaming, I'm yelling, I'm startling an animal. Take a look at source number 10. Itmar, argument. Chasma b'ko, you muzzle through speech. Then higa b'ko, or you lead the animal through speech. Rabbi Yochanan, Amir Chayav. You violate the biblical prohibition of lo tachsom shor b'disho. By the way, what happens if you violate the prohibition? It's a lo tase, it's a negative commandment. What happens if you violate a negative commandment according to Torah law? You get Malka, you get lashes, right? So he says, yes, you'd lash such an owner for doing that. Again, in the times of the judicial system. Reish Lakish, his chevruta and son-in-law, says, Pator, no, you're exempt. You don't violate the biblical prohibition of muzzling an animal through speech because you didn't do anything. You just screamed at the animal. And then each side explains their opinion, what I just told you. Rabbi Yochanan says, Chayev, akimas piv, have a maise. Opening your mouth is a maise, is an action. Reish Lakish says, you're exempt. Speaking is not an action. On this, the Tosvos, which is the line after, the great medieval commentator in the Talmud, ask a question. And they say, I don't understand. We have a principle in Jewish law. If you violate a negative prohibition and there's no action, right? Which is called lav shem b'maisa. For example, let's say you speak lashon hara about somebody. You speak ill about somebody. George is a no good, cheap, dishonest, horrific human being. I violated many biblical prohibitions by speaking ill about somebody. I should get lashes because I violated lashon hara. I said something bad about somebody. But we don't do that. Which is good, or else I've gotten beat up many times. The reason why we don't do that is because speech is considered lav shem b'maisa. Lav shem b'maisa and lo kino lav. A person who speaks lashon hara, you don't give them lashes because it falls under the category. You only get lashes for something that there's an action. And speech, there's no action. Doesn't that go against this principle? That is Tosfos' question on the Gemara. On that, Tosfos says there's a difference. Why? When you speak ill about somebody, you're just speaking. And then you stop speaking. When you scare an animal, stop! The animal then physically responds and moves its head. Because your action created a physical movement in the animal, you violate the prohibition of the lotase, of muzzling the mule, and you get lashes. And therefore, I love it. There is a yesh b'maisa. Why is yesh b'maisa? There's the maisa. What's the action? The action is the animal moved his head. Because of that, you can't get malka, you can get lashes. Because you did it, you violated a negative prohibition where there's an action according to Reish Lakish. According to the opinion that says you're chayv. Lam d'shataisvus. Beautiful. Okay. Another situation. There's a rule that one is not allowed to eat food that was cooked by a non-Jew. Bishalakam. Can't have it. Why? In the olden days, there's suspect of idol worship. Also, by having food that non-Jews cooked, it would lead to assimilation. So they did not want. But what do you need to do? All you need to do, if there's a big fire, is throw one piece of wood in the fire. You throw one piece of wood in the fire. If a Jew throws one piece of wood in the fire, it's considered that the whole thing is Jewish, and whatever egg is cooked, you can eat the egg. It's not a violation of Bishlak. It's not a violation of that a non-Jew cooked it. That's the rule. Jews need to be involved in the cooking process as well. Okay. What happens if instead of throwing a log into the fire, you do this? And by you blowing, those of you that have been to a campfire before, you blow at a campfire and the fire then spreads. Is that considered that you added fuel to the fire? Literally. Right? Says in source number 12, the last few words, Im nafach ba'esh have ke chi suri. Yes, nafach, you blow in the fire, it's like you added fuel. What's the difference? If you add a piece of wood or you blow on it, both ways, you've increased, you've enhanced, you participated, you engaged in the cooking process, albeit tangentially, but nonetheless, you still play an important role. By the way, you should know, this is very important because of another reason. Let's say we live in a very complex world, and there are these very large factories in Nebraska, North Carolina, where there's not so many Jews. But they have a very large plant, and they produce food. And they want this food to be kosher. They want certification. So what have up until now, they have to hire a kosher authority, hop on a plane, travel these places, inspect it, turn the pilot on, in order to get kosher certification. What about if I sit in shorts and t-shirt in the holy city of Lakewood or Toronto, sit in my basement, and what can I do? I don't need to go there. What can I do instead? Alexa, turn on the pilot in the plant in Nebraska. And the pilot light goes on. Is that considered that a Jew participated in the cooking process? Major ramifications. This could save kashrut organizations thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. You don't need to send people to these far-out factories. Another example, which is extremely practical, is some people are very strict on having a Jew supervise milk. Chal Yisrael. Now, even though in the olden days there was a big problem with having milk made by non-Jews because they would often add fat to enhance the volume of milk. Today, we no longer have that issue because of government policies. And so many people have become more relaxed, most people, many people, and therefore they will have any type of milk. You go to the milk at the store, Hershey's chocolate bars, there's milk in there. You go to the store, you buy milk, you go to Starbucks, other milk, seal test milk. That's not a problem. Why? Because we're no longer worried about fat being added because there's no way, seal test. We're like, oh, let's save some money and add some meat fat to the milk. They're not doing that. A, because it's probably more expensive, and B, the government inspection would shut them down in a second and they will lose millions and millions and millions of dollars. And the government inspection, and especially the world of dairy, is extremely, extremely strict. And it is simply not worth it. So we are not worried. The chances of any foreign substances in milk are basically zero. But there are those, the more Orthodox community, that say, okay, nonetheless, we want to have a Jew supervising it. We want a higher standard. So the coast restaurants in Toronto all abide by the higher standard. It has to be owners of dairy products that a Jewish person supervises. A lot of dairy farms are in far-out places. Can I sit right here at U of T, open up my camera, and have a camera at the dairy farm, and I'm watching? Is that considered that a Jew is involved, sees the process? Because there you just need to see. It's a much lower level. You don't have to get involved. You just have to see it. The other option, which is pretty neat, is if I need to even turn on equipment. I could turn on the various dairy equipment. Also, pressing a button through speech. These are major, major, major issues. I could change. In fact, you wouldn't have to send any mashgichim, any kosher supervision people. Just have digital cameras everywhere. You can watch everything. I could sit in an office and I could see 30, 40, 50 locations at the same time. You know how much money you'd save? Because they're traveling everywhere. A tremendous. Okay, so the role of video surveillance in Jewish law is a fascinating topic. That's not a topic. I just want to deal with the involved in participating in the cooking or baking process through speech. That would be a major implication for our topic. What's their status? Okay. So, we've seen here that all of a sudden we have a few cases that speech might actually count as an action. We see it in the realm of adding fuel to the fire. We see that muzzling an ox. The question is, can we extrapolate to areas of damages to the areas of Shabbat? Can we extrapolate to Nezikin, damages, property law, business, money? Can we extrapolate from that all the way to Shabbat for the Jewish Sabbath? That's not always a simple extrapolation. And you can't always draw the rules of monetary and money, those things, and draw them to Shabbat. But sometimes we have a higher or lower standard of things. The definitions aren't always interchangeable. Sometimes they are, but they might not be.
I think there's another difference too.
Yeah, what's the difference?
Especially with the blowing on the fire case, you're not using speech. You're using
breath.
Your mouth.
Okay.
You're using your mouth.
Very good. There's a fist. Right. Good.
Also, with scaring an animal, that's more like you're using noise than speech. Like there could be a difference. Noise is just naturally gonna scare the animal, but speech, like language.
So what would that? What do you think? If I take raw chicken, put it in an oven, and say, "Alexa, turn on oven, cooks the chicken," what would you say? Right?
I'm not sure, Rabbi.
Can you like ask a non-Jew to turn it on? Like technically,
because well, here's the problem with having a non-Jew turn it on.
Oh, they can't.
Bishalak, right? That would be another issue. When I cook, what do? I put my food in the oven. What do I do to the oven? I just turn the dial. I'm not doing anything. Isn't the oven cooking for me?
Starting the...
So, here's interesting. When it comes to cooking, is a very good example. I understand writing. I am writing on the Sabbath. I'm digging a ditch on the Sabbath. I'm sewing on the Sabbath. Those things, I am doing it. When it comes to cooking, Mr. Fire is cooking. Greenberg's not cooking. I'm not cooking the chicken. Mr. Fire's cooking the electricity. Cooking the chicken. Yet, we know that's one of the 39 Biblical Commandments. It's called cooking. So all of a sudden, when it comes to cooking, it's not my, I started, that's considered sufficient. If there's a fire already going, let's say I didn't even make the fire. We didn't start the fire. Right? Thank you for laughing. That means you know what I'm talking about. Everybody else, you're ignorant. The idea of cooking, if there's a fire that's raging, and I take raw chicken and I put it on the pre-existing fire, I violated cooking. I didn't cook the fire! No, the answer is you put the raw food on it, you violate the prohibition. That's all you need to do.
That's what cooking means.
Right, that's what cooking means. Right, that's exactly what cooking means. Okay? So, the question is going to be, how do we look at, when it comes to the Torah, what exactly is speech? What am I doing? Now, there's another example, the following. Let's say what's another example of how, right, this might not be speech, so you might not like this example. There's another biblical prohibition where I use the wind. It's called winnowing. What's winnowing? Winnowing is I take these grains, I throw them in the air, the wind comes, the chaff, the over it, these grains blows away, and I'm left with much more of the kernel for the next stage of the process. So winnowing. It's one of the prohibitions of Shabbat is winnowing. You're not allowed to winnow on Shabbos. So if winnowing is a problem, hey Sophie, how you doing? We're talking about speech in Jewish law. What's speech in Jewish law? So winnowing is using the wind, and that's how you violate that prohibition. So we see that using wind on Shabbat also might be a prohibition. You're not going to be happy with that either, because that's wind. That's a measurable something, right? So I was thinking, but maybe it's not really true. When you speak, aren't there reverberations? Aren't there some, you have to tell me in the physical world, there is something happening when I speak, right? So the difference between going, screaming at my animal, and talking, might not be so different.
Well, the examples of talking we had are with, spiritual stuff. So.
Right, so that I agree. Talking spiritually, that you can't draw a distinction from, we're going to throw that out the window. I just brought that, because they were funny cases, interesting cases. Right, but you can't, I agree, those you can't extrapolate from. That's pretty clear, for the most part. But the question is, what do you do about zoreh, which is winnowing? What do you do about helping us with Bishul Yisrael, which again is rabbinic, but still Bishul Yisrael? What do you do about lo tafnu shorbet yisho, about muzzling, that appears that you violate? So we see there
those are...
Those are the same din that they seem to imply that your speech, you might be considered... And also, the other example that's given is what happens if you, again, you blow and you cause a fire to burn down someone's property, you have to pay. For Nezikin, you'd have to pay. It's considered direct damages.
Saying, what's the flip side?
The flip side is what you're talking about, speech. There's no action. What are you really doing?
We only said that for the spiritual.
Right, spiritual stuff. So, no, again, the Bar Peluk, the Rish Lakish holds that you're not doing anything. Right? And how much can you extrapolate to Shabbat? Okay. So to say the following, Siri or Alexa, turn on the oven, and then I'm cooking my chicken, would that be considered violating the biblical prohibition of Bishul? So, of the biblical prohibition of cooking, right? By me saying, Siri, Alexa, turn on the oven, and the raw chicken that's in there now gets cooked, am I violating cooking, right? So, I don't know. I might be, because I'm turning it on. I'm causing it on. What am I doing in cooking? I'm turning on a dial, or I'm pressing a button on an oven? And everyone would agree that's biblical. So why is saying to Alexa to turn on my oven less of an issue than if I press a button to turn on an oven? Or to turn a dial to turn on an oven? It appears it might be the exact same thing. Right? What? Right? So again, doesn't if I tell Alexa to turn my oven on, or if I press a button to turn an oven on, or I turn a dial to turn an oven on, those all might be considered my action, and I might violate the prohibition of cooking. Even if you don't want to tell me that there's a biblical prohibition of using Alexa, there will be rabbinic issues. This to me is also a very interesting conversation that people are not necessarily familiar with. Number one, what's a rabbinic issue? Number one, source 15. Source 15 says, V'chabdo ma'asod drachecha. You have to honor to do your ways, referring to Shabbat. The Talmud says your dress must be different on Shabbat than your dress during the week. Right? I'm going to wear a pink shirt on Shabbat. Of course, I'll pink shirt today. I'll wear it on Shabbat. I would never wear a pink shirt. Right? Right? Masod rachecha shelo yehiluchecha shel Shabbat. You can't allow to walk the same way. And we know you're not allowed to run on Shabbat. You want to run on Tuesday? Run Tuesday. You can't run on Shabbat. You want to run to synagogue to do a mitzvah, to do a good thing, you're allowed to. But just to run on Shabbat, that's a problematic. You're mitzvah chavatzecha. By the way, these are all verses in Isaiah that the Talmud learns from each one of them about the laws. They're rabbinic, right? About the, so you have to speak, you're going to have to walk differently, have to dress differently. And chavatzecha asurim. Your chavatzim, your items are also different on Shabbat, right? The items, what you handle, has to be different on Shabbat, right? We don't handle pens, we don't handle hammers, we don't handle those things. Our items are different that we have on Shabbat. The daver, davar, our speech is different. You're not to speak the same way. You would not be, it'd be considered a rabbinic prohibition to say, I'm going to drive my car tomorrow. Why? Because to speak about driving a car is dibur chol. You're not allowed to say such a thing. You can say, I'm going to go somewhere tomorrow, because you can go anywhere by walking. But you're not allowed to use language on Shabbat, the language of a malacha, that I'm going to write this by hand, although no one does that anymore. I'm going to drive that. I'm going to build. I'm looking forward tomorrow to building a house. That would be a problem to say on Shabbat, right? Which, by the way, is why you're not allowed to ask a non-Jew to do things for you on Shabbat. It might be a violation of, you're not allowed to say such words. You can't do it. You're not allowed to. Other opinions are you can't have a non-Jew do for you because they're your agent. You can't have, that's also an issue. Okay? And that's exactly that is brought down in Shulchan Aruch in Source 16 and also in Source 17. So the first issue with having Alexa, cook for me. Alexa, turn the oven on. That might be a problem of Daber, Davar, speech. Next. The Mishnah and the Talmud in Source 18 has an example. You like to turn on, let's say, before Shabbat starts, you want to run your flour mill. Now, I'm sure you don't own a flour mill, and I'm also pretty sure you've never been to a flour mill. But in the olden days, people actually had flour mills. And it was a very noisy process. Why? Because you'd be grinding. What's a flour mill? You're grinding. Again, these go back to kernels, you're turning them into a powder. It's a lot of grinding. Can you, let's say before Shabbat starts, I turn it on, my grinding mill, let it grind on Shabbat. I'm not doing anything. I turn it on before Shabbat. Is that a problem? What am I doing? I'm not doing anything. The answer is yes or no. From a biblical perspective, not a problem. Oh, if I turn it on a Shabbat, I'm grinding. That would be a problem. But before Shabbat, what am I doing wrong? The Talmud says don't do it. You know why? It makes a lot of noise. It makes a lot of noise. It ruins your peace on Shabbat. And others say it's not about peace on Shabbat. But people might think that you turned it on Shabbat. You should know, by the way. People don't realize this. The great rabbinic authority, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, was against using timers on lights when timers first came out. Why? Because I'll go by Greenberg's house, I'll be like, oh, the lights are on. And then you come back 3 hours later and the lights are off. Hey, that Greenberg guy is a scammer. How do those lights go off? Now it's common. Everyone knows about timers. We're so careful. Electricity, blah, 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 blah. Everyone knows there's something called timers. But when the timers first came out, he was not happy with timers on Shabbat because people are going to think that you're doing something wrong. Lights go on, lights go off. But now they're accepted and people do it all the time. It's not a problem. Because people know that you're not doing anything. So you're allowed to have timers turn things on for you. That's not a problem. But what about a mill? It says the Talmud, a mill makes too much noise. This comes out with dishwashers on Shabbat are a problem, right? Even the modern day dishwashers are quieter. The other issue with dishwashers is that you actually have to press a button for them to go on. That's an issue. This comes up with, what about your heating? What about your heating and your air conditioning? You're like, don't tell me this. Right? How come we don't say before Shabbat starts, shut off your heating? Shut off your air conditioning in the summer. I wish that was a problem now. Okay, that's a different issue in Israel. I don't want to even talk about that, right? Good question. How can we don't say how can we use that? The answer is very simple. Two reasons. One, heating is in Toronto these days, it's people they have no choice. You need heating. But two, our heats are very quiet. How much noise does it make when the heat goes on? You're like, Is the heat on? Wait, is the heat on? Right, and you put your foot over the vent in order for heat to be on. Oh, good, my heat's on.
I'm at an air conditioner.
What?
That literally kept me up the whole night.
Kept me up
the whole
night. Okay, so that's one. So A, they're quiet, and B, everyone has the Monsanto problem. No one's going to think that Greenberg turned it on. Everyone has it on. It's called the thermostat. What about an air conditioner?
What if you need the air conditioner to sleep? What if you're used to it?
Right, you're so used to it. Right, you're so used to the noise. Okay, so air conditioning is less of an issue because even though it's noisy, it's so common today using thermostats that everyone does it. And if you have a noisy air conditioner, just get a new one. No, I don't know. It's a good question about noisy air conditioners. It's an interesting question. I don't know. It appears we're lenient on it, right? Everyone uses it. So, but fans are quiet. And today, this happens a few times. No one wants to have wet clothes over Shabbat. So what do you sometimes do before Shabbat starts? Your last load of laundry, right? We have someone come to our house to help us clean up and sort things out Shabbat afternoon. And often she finishes the last load and it's almost Shabbat before she's at the house. So can you dry your clothes on Shabbat? So the answer, you don't want to have them wet over Shabbat. So the answer one is, if you put it in half hour before candlelighting, even though it's a few minutes into it, it'd be okay because it's not really dark yet. And also, the new dryers today, you close the door, you don't hear a thing. You don't hear a thing, and again, it's done before Shabbat. So, but Alexa! Yes, speaks to you, makes noise, and a loud noise, right? So that might be a problem of noise on Shabbat using Alexa. That's maybe less I'm certain about, but I think there's something to it.
Isn't it because the noise is annoying?
No, there's a noise, right? I mean, it's considered into, by the way, this was one of the issues where Moshe Feinstein didn't like microphones on Shabbat because you're making noise, right? You're making noise, there's extra noise. Radio's on Shabbat, right? TV's on Shabbat. These are all because of these extra noises that are considered. Okay, microphone, at least potentially, could add to the environment of Shabbat, right? But other things like radios and televisions, those are things that you put on before. And what's the problem? The issue is he felt that it was a violation of what the day really,
it's not about
what
the
day
is about. It's just about
right.
Not
right. So, but again, not Shabbos day because it's the loudness of the noise. Hashmat kol, he says. The violation of Hashmat kol is an issur d'rabbanan. Okay, those are the... those are a number of examples that I wanted to kind of demonstrate in terms of speech. So, a few things. Number one, we spoke about how we view speech according to Jewish thought and Jewish law. So yes, even though God created the world through speech, and even though maybe Bezalel knew how to create things through speech, to argue that if I kill somebody with words that it's considered murder. It's very hard to argue that it's considered murder. I might be responsible rabbinically, I might be responsible morally, but to say that I violated don't murder, lo tirtzach, is going to be hard to imagine. But I think the concept of speech, we have to be very careful about. Because nonetheless, we do see examples that if I blow on the fire, if I muzzle an animal, another example that's given is by a rooster. I forgot about this example. If a rooster screams and the rooster shatters glass, the owner of the rooster is responsible because you're responsible for your property. If your property damages, something you have to pay. That's from a biblical perspective. Again, it's the world of Nezikin and damages. The world of Zorea, the world of winnowing is about wind, right? That's clearly the biblical prohibition. It's winnowing, right? Wind and speech. And even if you want to tell me that all those examples are very bad examples, that it's not biblical, it for sure is going to be rabbinic. Why? Either l'daber davar, your speech, or because of this excessive noise. Those would be other reasons, right? Or excessive noise, or people might think that you're doing something on Shabbat. But all these reasons, rabbinically, it would also be a problem as well. And I'll tell you what's fascinating, and that is how we view speech is a very powerful thing in Judaism, in Jewish thought, and Jewish law. And I think that we'd be very careful with what we say, So much so that apparently Alexa can predict divorce better than most therapists. Right? Why? Because Alexa always hears you. And the concept that whatever we say actually matters and is listening is, I think, something which is important to remind ourselves about. I do not think, however, you'd have to unplug Alexa before Shabbat. I don't think you have to unplug these devices. Sometimes everyone needs a word, a prompt word. Alexa, right? Needs a prompt word. When you use a prompt word, then it like heightens in terms of listening and responding. Now, it's always listening to you. It's always listening to you. But that you're not aware of, it doesn't help you. You don't really care. It doesn't really matter to you. And therefore, I don't think you'd have to unplug your Alexa before Shabbat. But I think, obviously, you can't say that word Alexa on Shabbat because it's going to prompt it to listen and respond. But to use Alexa or any other device, I think would be problematic. And how we view speech is fascinating because this has major ramifications, like I said, to kashrut agencies. That if you could talk, press a button, sitting in your shorts and t-shirt in your basement or in your Bet Midrash, and therefore you could turn on plants in Nebraska and not have to send people out there, or if you can count them as a Jew watching the cooking process or watching animals being milked, be a tremendous, tremendous savings in for the Jewish community. Interesting enough, Chabad says that it's considered Chav Yisrael if there's a video camera and the person's not even there, that would be sufficient, the status of Yisrael. That has not been accepted, believe it or not. Many people agree to it, but because there's certain communities that do not, and it's about money, they have to make sure that everyone agrees to it, or else it's not good for business. But probably Nikar Adin, the essential part of the law, is, yeah, if there's video camera, that's sufficient. Surveillance cameras would be sufficient in order to do all these things. So we're going to be, in many ways, it's a revolution. I think it's an important idea. What is the power of speech and how it can transform things and how it can affect things, especially in the very digital world that we live in? It can have a tremendous impact on the lives around us for the better, but at the same time, be aware of what we say has an impact. It can also be very damaging and creative. It all depends on where and when. Okay, let's stop there for now.
There's got to be a Gemara which is like telling your animals different jobs, you know?
So the Torah says,